Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger for Sunday, October 8th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. We're going to start off the first half with the Mason City Globe-Gazette with the article, Trump Makes Iowa Stop, in lead-up to caucus. Thousands came out on Sunday to see former President and Republican frontrunner Donald Trump as he made a campaign stop at the National Cattle Congress. It's one of the slew of stops Trump has made in the state leading up to the Iowa caucuses in January, including one in Cedar Rapids the same day. Trump used the opportunity to address his supporters. Things are not the same as they were just 3 years ago when you take a look. They weren't ever as good, and now they are really probably maybe the worst we've ever seen in terms of our country, Trump said. You need to get every patriot you know and make sure that they're registered and get them out to vote and get them to go to their local precinct caucus meeting at 7 p.m. on Monday, January 15th, he said. Urging his supporters to vote, he likened the election to going to war with some very evil people. We are not going to have a country left if we don't win this election, Trump said. And I used to say that about 2016. This is the most important election, and I mean it. This is now the most important election. Trump touched on a variety of topics, speaking about immigration, the economy, and the war in Ukraine, and the recent terrorist attacks in Israel. He also talked about his legal troubles. And here's him talking. Now, the nice part about my indictments is that they've driven us up because they realize they're fake and phony, he said. I'm the only person that ever got indicted whose poll numbers shot up through the roof, he boasted. The rally was organized by the Republicans of Black Hawk County. Committee members April Melton said that she's been making calls since May and found out last Friday that Trump would stop in Waterloo. It's fantastic to see all my friends and my local community members come out and support a former president and the frontrunner in the 2024 elections, Melton said. The majority of those in attendance were local, including Naira Akey from Waterloo, a retiree. Akey worked at Hy-Vee until recently to supplement her income. She said that is one of her main reasons for supporting Trump. I'm tired of the economy. I'm tired of all the freebies people get, Akey said. I'm 78 years old and still working. There's something wrong with this picture. Another local supporter who waited in line to see the former president was Kevin Wolf. Wolf said that he was always a fan of Trump, the celebrity, but only voted for him in 2016 out of opposition to Hillary Clinton, but he became a supporter after seeing him in office. He's the best president we've ever had, and I'm hoping to see him back in office, Wolf said, or at least someone with the same kind of ideals as him. The event attracted people from outside Waterloo's Cedar Falls area as well. Friends Nicole Nosbisch and Connie Dienda were among them. Nosbisch came from Clear Lake. Born with her right side weaker than her left, she said that Trump's policies have been beneficial to those with medical disadvantages. This included the 2018 Right to Try Act, which allows terminal patients to try new procedures before they are fully approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Nosbisch also credits Trump with awakening her interest in politics, saying he inspired her to potentially run for office. We need a voice. That's why I want to run for office, to inspire people like myself, Nosbisch said, because some don't have a voice or don't know how to vote because they never get taught. Dianda came out of Mason City, where she's running for the school board. Having spent time living in California, she said that she was appreciative of Iowa caucuses being the first in the nation. He's the greatest president that we've had in history of the United States, barring Lincoln, perhaps, Dianda said. So, I'm just so happy and proud that he's running again. Dianda also denounced the legal issues Trump has faced in recent months. It's just a crime what they're doing, she said. It's election interference is what they're doing. In addition to being the venue for Trump's rally, the National Cattle Congress was holding the site for nearly 400 undocumented immigrants taken into custody during the agriprocessors raid in Postville. The 2008 raid, carried out during the George W. Bush administration, was the largest workplace U.S. immigration raid in U.S. history up to that point. Around 300 of those detained received jail sentences and were deported. Several agriprocessors' managers, including Chief Executive Officer Shalom Rubashkin, also went to prison. Rubashkin received a 27-year sentence after being convicted on 86 counts of financial crimes. 72 immigration charges were dropped after his final fraud convictions. In 2017, Trump commuted Rubashkin's prison sentence after 8 years served. Now let's move on to the article. Voter rolls a new battleground to amateur sleuths hunt fraud. A group has been impersonating government officials, harassing New York residents at their homes, and falsely accusing them of breaking the law, state officials warned. What sounds like a scam aimed at people's pocketbooks is actually part of a shakedown with a much different target, voters. State prosecutors sent a cease and desist order to a group of New York citizens audit demanding that it halt any unlawful voter deception and intimidation efforts. It's the type of tactic that concerns many state election officials across the country as conservative groups, some with ties to allies of former President Donald Trump, and motivated by false claims of widespread fraud in 2020, push to access and sometimes publish state voter registration rolls, which list names, home addresses, and in some cases party registration. Our goal is to create free online databases for groups and individuals who want to take it upon themselves to try and find potential fraud. The list could find their way into the hands of malicious actors, and individual efforts to inspect the rolls could disenfranchise voters through intimidation or canceled registrations, state election officials and privacy advocates warn. They worry local election offices may be flooded with challenges to voter registration listings as those agencies prepare for the 2024 elections. John Davison, director of litigation at the Electronic Privacy Information Center, said the concern reflects competing interests over voter data, a need to protect voter rolls from cybersecurity attacks against the desire to make them accessible so elections are transparent. Baseless claims of widespread voter fraud are part of what's driving the efforts to obtain the rolls, leading to lawsuits over whether to hand over data in several states, including Maine and New Mexico and Pennsylvania. In New York, a warning from the State Election Board preceded the cease and desist letter from the State Attorney General's office. Voters in 13 counties were approached at their homes in an apparently coordinated effort by people impersonating election officials, in some cases wielding phony IDs, the board said. Residents were confused about their voter registration status and accused of misconduct. In one instance, people were wearing identification badges, accused a Glen Falls woman of committing a crime by being registered to vote in two counties. Warren County spokesman Don Lamanton said, "The woman already filed to change her registration, and the canvassers apparently used an out-of-date information," he said. "She was quite shaken by the whole thing," Lehman said. "She did nothing nefarious at all. Either these people don't understand that or understand how the process works, but it seems they were quite accusatory." State prosecutors found no evidence that any of those contacted committed voter fraud or any other type of crime, they said in their warning letter. New York Citizens Audit emailed a statement that dismissed as absurd concerns that its canvassers might have impersonated an official or harassed anyone. Instead, the group urged election officials to investigate each of those millions of suspected illegal registrations. "We train our people to do legal canvassing, and if ever verified, voter intimidation would be completely unacceptable and against our policy," New York Citizens Audit Director Kim Herman said in the statement. Republican Doug Troux of Illinois founded one of the most ambitious groups, the Voter Reference Foundation, after the 2020 presidential election with the goal of posting online lists from every state. The VoteRef.com database includes information from 32 states and the District of Columbia, and is run by Gina Swoba, a former organizer of Trump's 2020 campaign in Arizona. A federal trial is scheduled to start later this month over the group's fight to access and use New Mexico's voter registration list. The group also sued Pennsylvania, which refused to hand over the information and said publishing it would put every registered voter at greater risk of identity theft or misuse of their information, the state's Office of Open Records said. We have a crisis of confidence in America when it comes to election results, Trauk said in a statement on Pennsylvania case. And the answer is more transparency, not less. The head of elections in New Mexico, Secretary of State Maggie Toloz Oliver, fears that many voters might withdraw from registration lists as personal data is posted online. Her office cites email inquiries about how to cancel voter registration during a canvassing effort by election activists last year in southern New Mexico. Voters can and should expect a reasonable amount of privacy, said Toloz Oliver, a Democrat. The Voter Reference Foundation argues that federal law is on its side, citing that public disclosure provisions of the National Voter Registration Act that require states to make a reasonable effort to keep the registration lists free of people who died or moved away. The foundation also invokes free speech and due process rights. Nearly every state prohibits the use or transfer of the lists for commercial purposes, while several confine access to potential candidates, parties for campaign purposes, and some government activities. Now let's move on to the article. GOP hopefuls blame Biden deal with Iran after Hamas attack. Former President Donald Trump and other GOP contenders tried to lay blame on the Biden administration after Hamas militants launched the deadliest attack on Israel in decades, citing a $6 billion transfer to Iran that administration officials insisted Saturday had yet to be spent. Hamas surprised early this morning attack during a major Jewish holiday Saturday marks a new foreign policy front in a presidential election that has been unusually dominated by foreign affairs. Russia's ongoing invasion of Ukraine divided the Republican field, with some like Trump and the Florida governor Ron DeSantis questioning the U.S.'s continued involvement, while others like former President Mike Pence insist that supporting the Ukrainian military is vital to the U.S. national security interests. On Saturday, the candidates appeared united, standing with Israel. The Hamas terrorist invasion of Israeli territory and the murder of Israeli soldiers today and the brutal murder of citizens is an act of savagery and that must be crushed, Trump said in an appearance in Waterloo, Iowa. It has to be dealt with very powerfully. He also argued that under Biden, the U.S. is perceived as being weak and ineffective on the global stage, opening the door to hostility. They didn't have that level of aggression with me. They didn't have it. And this would never have happened with me either, Trump claimed. Much of the Republican criticism focused on a complex deal by the Biden administration in September to release 5 U.S. citizens detained in Iran. As part of the deal, roughly $6 billion in frozen Iranian assets being held in South Korea were transferred to an account in Doha, Qatar. Although Hamas is a Sunni Muslim group, it has a militant wing that has long nurtured close ties with Iran. A source of funding and a Shiite powerhouse. Hamas and Iran are being brought together by a shared enmity towards Israel. Administration officials said Saturday that no money in the Doha account so far has been spent. The $6 billion figure is not U.S. taxpayer money, senior Biden administration officials stressed at the time of the deal, but rather payments made by South Korea to Iran to buy oil in recent years. The funds have been stuck in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions. The money is now held in a restricted account in Doha and is meant to be used solely for humanitarian purposes such as food and medicine for Iranians and handled by what administration described as vetted non-Iranian vendors. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi said his country would spend the money wherever we need it, though the U.S. said in response that it would exercise rigorous oversight over how the funds are dispersed and could freeze the assets again if needed. DeSantis, in a video statement, accused Biden of policies that have gone easy on Iran and helped to fill their coffers. Israel is now paying the price for these policies. We're going to stand with the state of Israel. They need to root out Hamas, and we need to stand up to Iran. South Carolina Senator Tim Scott alleged the attack was the Biden's $6 billion ransom payment at work. We didn't just invite this aggression, we paid for it, he said in a statement. Adrienne Watson, a spokesperson for the White House and National Security Council, said that she could not directly address the Republican criticism due to federal restrictions, but I can clarify the facts, not a single cent from those funds has been spent. And when it is spent, it can only be spent on things like food and medicine for the Iranian people, she said, she said Saturday in a statement. These funds have absolutely nothing to do with the horrific attacks today, and this is not the time to spread disinformation. Brian Nelson, Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence at the Treasury, also stressed that these restricted funds cannot go to Iran, and that any suggestion to the contrary is false and misleading. Pence also blamed Biden, saying that the current administration projects weakness on the world stage and kowtows the mullahs in Iran. But in an appearance in Iowa, Pence also turned the focus on his GOP rivals who have been advocating more isolationist policies, particularly on Ukraine, calling the attack a testament to the fact that we need new leadership in the White House, but we also need leadership in the Republican Party that understands the stakes, that understands we achieve peace through strength. Now on to a related article. Netanyahu declares war. Hamas attacks towns, more than 200 killed, 1,000 hurt on each side. Backed by a barrage of rockets, dozens of Hamas militants broke out of the blockade Gaza Strip and into nearby Israeli towns, killing dozens and abducting others in an unprecedented surprise early morning attack during a major Jewish holiday Saturday. A stunned Israeli later launched airstrikes in Gaza, with a Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declaring that the country is at war with Hamas and vowing to inflict an unprecedented price. Hamas gunmen rolled into as many as 22 locations outside of the Gaza Strip, including towns and other communities as far as 15 miles from the Gaza border. In some places, they roamed for hours, gunning down civilians and soldiers as Israeli military scrambled to muster a response. Gun battles continued into the night, and militants held hostages in standoffs in two towns and occupied a police station in a third. The leader of the Hamas military wing, Mohammed Daif, said the assault was in response to the 16-year blockade of Gaza, Israeli raids on the West Bank, violence at disputed Jerusalem holy site, Al-Aqsa, a growth of Israeli settlements and increasing attacks by Israeli settlers on Palestinians. Israeli media, citing rescue service officials, said at least 250 people were killed and 150 wounded in the deadliest attack in Israeli in decades. At least 232 people in the Gaza Strip were killed and at least 1,700 wounded in Israeli strikes. The Palestinian Health Ministry said Hamas fighters took captives into Gaza. The conflict threatened to escalate to an even deadlier stage with Israeli vows of greater retaliation. In a televised address Saturday night, Netanyahu said the military will use all of its strength to destroy Hamas capabilities. He vowed to defeat the militants and take revenge for this black day. President Joe Biden, who spoke with Netanyahu in a call, decried Hamas' appalling assault, and his administration pledged to ensure Israel has what it needs to defend itself. Secretary of State Antony Blinken rushed to the White House for meetings and phoned foreign counterparts while Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin spoke with Israeli Defense Minister. Israeli airstrikes in Gaza intensified after nightfall, flattening residential buildings. In giant explosions, including a 14-story tower that held dozens of apartments, as well as Hamas offices in central Gaza City. Israeli forces fired a warning just before. After one Israeli strike, a Hamas rocket barrage hit four cities, including Tel Aviv and a nearby suburb. Throughout the day, Hamas fired more than 3,500 rockets, the Israeli military said. Palestinians demonstrated in towns and cities across the West Bank on Saturday night. Palestinian health officials said Israeli fire killed five there. Netanyahu's office said Israeli would stop supplying electricity and fueling goods to Gaza. About 3 a.m. Sunday, a loudspeaker atop a mosque in Gaza City warned nearby residents, "Evacuate immediately." Minutes later, an Israeli airstrike reduced a five-story building to ashes. Now on to the article. U.S. delegation arrives in China. Senators make first congressional trip to the country in 4 years. A senior American lawmaker leading the first congressional trip to China in 4 years said Saturday that the U.S. does not want to cut economic ties with the world's second largest economy, but seeks a level playing field so American companies can compete freely. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and five other senators arrived in Shanghai earlier in the day on a three-country tour that will take them to South Korea and Japan. The trip covers amid a sharp deterioration in relations between the U.S. and China as officials try to lay the groundwork for a possible meeting between Presidents Joe Biden and Xi Jinping in November. "We are prepared to compete, but we do not seek conflict," Schumer told Shanghai's Communist Party chief shortly after the delegation arrived. The party head, Xi Jinping, avoided specific issues in public remarks, saying healthy and stable China-U.S. relationship would benefit the entire world. He noted the presence of 5,640 American companies in Shanghai and said he is happy to have the opportunity to discuss how to promote trade at the local level. The U.S. has placed tariff on other trade restrictions on China over national security, human rights and other concerns, and blocked access to advanced semiconductors and other key technologies. China accused the U.S. of seeking to contain its development as it emerges as a global power. Schumer said that the U.S. wants the Chinese people to have increased economic opportunity, but many Americans feel China does not treat U.S. companies fairly. "We believe that we need reciprocity, allowing American companies to compete as freely in China as Chinese companies are able to compete here," he said. A series of high-ranking Biden administration officials met their Chinese counterparts in Beijing in recent months, but Schumer and his colleagues are the first American lawmakers to make the trip to China since China lifted its COVID-19 restrictions last December. The delegation of three Democrats and three Republicans landed on a U.S. government jet on an overcast and windy afternoon. The Republicans were led by Idaho Senator Mike Crapo, the senior member of his party on the Senate Finance Committee. Schumer is a New York Democrat. China, in a statement earlier this past week, said that it hoped the visit would contribute to a more objective understanding of China in the U.S. Congress. Schumer also raised the issues of Chinese companies that stopped making fentanyl, but which the U.S. government says continue to supply the ingredients for the production of deadly opioid drug in Mexico. "They are fueling the fentanyl crisis that is poisoning communities across the United States," he said. "Everyone of us knows families who have lost young men and women to fentanyl." China said that it maintains strict control of the chemicals to ensure they are not exported for illegal purposes, and that the U.S. should stop shifting blame for its failure to curb drug abuse. In a reminder of the tensions between the two countries, China's Commerce Ministry said Saturday that the new U.S. restrictions placed on 42 Chinese companies were a typical act of economic coercion and unilateral bullying. Now let's go on to the article. Powerful quake and aftershocks shake Afghanistan. Local authorities say about 100 people are dead, 500 others left injured. A powerful magnitude 6.3 earthquake followed by a strong aftershocks killed dozens of people Saturday in western Afghanistan, its natural disaster authority said. The United Nations gave preliminary figure of 320 dead, but later said that the figure was still being verified. Local authorities gave an estimate of 100 people killed and 500 injured. According to the same update from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the update also said that 465 houses had been reportedly destroyed and a further 135 were damaged. Partners and local authorities anticipate the number of casualties to increase as search and rescue efforts continue amid reports that some people may be trapped under collapsed buildings, the UN said. Disaster Authority spokesperson Mohammed Abdullah Jan said four villages in the Zhendeyan district in Herat province bore the brunt of the quake and aftershocks. The United States Geological Survey said the quake's epicenter was about 25 miles northwest of Herat City. It was followed by three very strong aftershocks, measuring 6.3, 5.9, and 5.5, as well as lesser shocks. The World Health Organization in Afghanistan said that it dispatched 12 ambulance cars to Zhendeyan to evacuate casualties to hospitals. As deaths and casualties from the earthquakes continue to be reported, teams are in hospitals assisting treatment of the wounded and assessing additional needs. The U.S. agency said on X, the social media platform formerly known as Twitter. Now let's read the article. Government: Russia hit rebel areas in Syria. Syrian and Russian bombardment of rebel-held parts of northwest Syria claimed seven more lives and wounded others Saturday, 2 days after the country's deadliest attack on a government target in years, a war monitor and paramedic group said. Thursday's drone strike on the Homs Military Academy killed 89 people and wounded as many as 270, the health ministry said. On Saturday, Syrian artillery pounded towns and villages held by rebels in Idlib province, killing 7 and wounding 10, according to the opposition's Syrian Civil Defense, also known as the White Helmets. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported insurgents fired rockets on government-held areas, and Russian warplanes carried out four airstrikes on rebel-held region. Another brief article, seven Ecuador assassination suspects slain in prisons. A seventh man accused in the August assassination of an Ecuadorian presidential candidate was killed inside a prison in Ecuador's capital, authorities said Saturday, a day after six others from Colombia and allegedly linked to the crime were slain in a different lockup. The killing of seven suspects happened a little more than a week before Ecuador holds a presidential runoff election, and as officials struggle to explain how this was possible. The prison system said that the seventh man killed was held at a prison in Quito, Ecuador's capital. Six Colombian men charged in the August 9th assassination of Fernando Villavicencio, 59, were killed on Friday in a prison in Guayaquil. Prosecutor's office is expected to soon announce the conclusion of the investigation stage into Villavicencio's killing. Now time for one more brief article for the Mason City Globe-Gazette. The article, Taylor, Colts agree on 3-year, $42 million extension. All-pro running back Jonathan Taylor and the Indianapolis Colts agreed on a contract extension Saturday, the team announced. A person with knowledge of the details told the Associated Press the deal is worth $42 million, with $26.5 million guaranteed over the 3 years. The person spoke on condition of anonymity because the terms have not yet been revealed publicly. San Francisco's Christian McCaffrey, $16 million annually, and the New Orleans' Alvin Kamara, $15 million, are now the only running backs making more than Taylor per year. The agreement was announced after the Colts activated Taylor from the physically unable to perform list and removed the questionable designation from his status for Sunday's game against the Tennessee Titans. Taylor started off the season on the list following an ankle surgery and an ugly off-season contract dispute. He missed all of the team's off-season workouts and all of the training camp while rehabbing from surgery. Taylor has been frustrated with the amount of money teams are paying running backs. He complained about league owners undervaluing running backs in general, citing that $10.1 million franchise tag number. It's the lowest of any position other than kickers or punters. He eventually made a trade request, and then the Colts gave him permission to find a trade partner. Taylor returned to practice this week and was eager Thursday to put the dispute behind him and get back on the field. If somebody wasn't committed, they wouldn't be here. Right now, I'm here, and my number one goal is really to attack this first practice, Taylor said in his first public comments since June. It's been over 290 days, I believe. When you're not doing what you love, you're going to notice it. So my main goal has been to attack this first day. The return of Taylor will bolster the Colts' offense. Zach Moss has played well in three starts, and the offers a solid changeup option to the speedy 2021 NFL rushing champ. Indy also has a dual-threat rookie quarterback, Anthony Richardson, who is the first Super Bowl-era quarterback with four touchdown returns in his first three games.
You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Sunday, October 8th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn over to the Fort Dodge Messenger section of this reading. Starting off with the article, This is What Dad Would Do. SOS Community Show Support to Fallen Officers' Family During Pay It Forward Friday. 4 years after the tragic and sudden death of Reverend Al Henderson, the grief of those who loved him and knew him the most is still raw. But so is the desire to serve others and to make a positive impact on the community around them. On Friday, members of the Fort Dodge community spent the entire day working to spread kindness and nurture Henderson's legacy of service to others with the fourth annual Pay It Forward Friday. Promoted by Serving Our Servants, the organization founded by Henderson in 2014, dedicated to serving first responders, Pay It Forward Friday really belongs to the community as a whole, SOS President T.J. Pingle said. Henderson, who was the lead pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church, was also the chaplain for local law enforcement and fire agencies. In the afternoon, SOS and the Henderson family hosted an event at City Square Park, where they invited the public for ice cream and hot cocoa to make cards and send to the family of the fallen Algona police officer Kevin Cram. Cram was killed in the line of duty on September 13th and leaves behind a wife and three sons. The Cram family loss is something that Henderson family understands deeply, Candy Lovin said. Our circumstances were different, but we still had a sudden loss, so it just feels appropriate to reach out to somebody else, too. She said, It's not even just from us, it's from Fort Dodge, too. Lovin, who is the oldest daughter of Al and Chris Henderson, said that she followed the aftermath of Cram's death, where communities across northwest and north central Iowa came together to raise money to help the grieving family, and she knew that Pay It Forward Friday would be the perfect opportunity to garner more support for the Crams. This is what Dad would do, Lovin said. This is what he would want. And he would have been involved in any way to support that in this community. SOS also collected free will donations to be given to the Cram family. This is in addition to the more than $38,000 that Fort Dodge area businesses pledged to donate from touchdowns scored at Fort Dodge, Dodger, and St. Edmund Gale football games. In the morning, members of the Fort Dodge Police Department, Webster City County Sheriff's Office, and Fort Dodge Fire Department handed out gift cards at local stores. Representatives from the Safe Communities Coalition for Fort Dodge and Webster City also passed out gift cards. Legacy Realty paid for drinks for customers at local coffee shops. Kelsey Chiropractic Clinic provides treats and coffees to its patients for the day. Staff from the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services took sweet treats, games, and art supplies to the residents of the YMCA of Fort Dodge. Citizens Community Credit Union gave gift cards to its members. And countless other organizations, businesses, and individuals also honored Pastor Al's legacy in their own ways. People look forward to this day, Pingle said. There's businesses and people who may not have even known Al, but they found out about it today, and they've gone out and started doing it just to spread kindness in Fort Dodge. Especially after this year that we've had and all the work these guys and gals have had to do, it's kind of nice seeing give back. Seeing how Pay It Forward Friday has grown each year is touching, Chris Henderson's widow said. To see the effect of a memory of him carry him Terry even to people who maybe didn't know him, but they wish they had. I just look around, and the support they've given, it makes you speechless, Chris Henderson said. I wish I could tell him how proud I felt. Though Pay It Forward Friday is celebrated on the first Friday in October, every day can be a day to live out his legacy and service of others. Now on to the article, Housing Area Youth Exchange on Agenda for Fort Dodge Council. A new housing area will be considered on the Fort Dodge City Council on Monday. Called the Lazy Tree Subdivision, it would be located at the northwest end of the Fort Dodge Country Club golf course. But before the council begins to talk about houses, it will be updated on the youth exchange program with Kosovo. The council meeting will begin at 5:30 p.m. Monday in the municipal building at 819 First Avenue South with a workshop on the Kosovo Youth Exchange. In 2016, Fort Dodge entered a sister city relationship with Jakova, which is in Kosovo, a nation in the Balkans area of Europe. Since then, groups of Fort Dodge teenagers have regularly visited Jakova. The council's business meetings will begin at 6 p.m. That's when the Lazy Tree subdivision will be discussed. The proposal calls for 11.2-acre housing area in the golf course, which is east of U.S. Highway 169 and north of 2nd Avenue South. The council will consider the first reading of a measure to change the site's zoning from a conservation designation to a residential one. Council members will also consider awarding $936,000 contract to McClure Engineering Co. of Fort Dodge for designing some major upcoming water projects. Those projects include a water main connection on the northwest side, a connection improvements on the water tower on South 32nd Street, water valve replacement throughout the city, a new water main along Kenyon Road between U.S. Highway 169 and Triton Circle, water main replacement between Avenue O and Avenue B, and water main replacement on North 7th Street by Loomis Park. Now let's go on to the article. Webster City is awarded $55,000 for a splash pad by State Tourism Group. Webster City was granted $55,000 on Thursday by the CAT Review Committee in Des Moines for a proposed splash pad in the East Twin Park. The announcement drew excitement from the city. Awesome, City Manager Daniel Ortiz Hernandez said in an email when he was notified of the award. We are thankful for the Iowa Economic Development Authority, IEDA, support and contribution to the City of Webster's Splash Pad project. IEDA is committed to helping communities thrive and recognize the values of this project to support our community's diverse families and attract a vibrant workforce. Our assistant city manager, Bridonna Bishop, and recreation and public grounds director, Brianna Lesher, worked tirelessly on this project and grant application since the city council adopted its goal, which they wished to see completed back in May 2022. They deserve a tremendous level of gratitude for their efforts and commitment to our community, Bishop said. It is an exciting to have received the Enhanced Iowa Community Attraction and Tourism Grant for the Splash Pad project in Webster City. The board spoke highly of the project and was positive about financially supporting the completion of the Splash Pad in Webster City. Webster City is seeking a way to help pay for the Splash Pad, which has an estimated cost of at least $450,000 initially and from $65,000 to $70,000 annually in operations. Previously, Secnia Foundry donated $50,000 to the project. Other smaller donations have also been reported, and the fundraising is ongoing. Lesher has said previously, the Splash Pad will provide a welcoming environment for families to gather and socialize, strengthening community bonds and fostering a sense of togetherness. It is designed to accommodate individuals of all abilities, providing an inclusive space where everyone can participate in active water play. The project will also serve as an opportunity to attract visitors from neighboring areas, creating a positive economic impact on local businesses, potentially increasing tourism, and supporting our local economy. Anyone wishing to contribute can contact Lesher by calling at 515-832-9125. Now, let's read the article. Tom Thumb Drive-In's owner seeks buyer who will continue its traditions. One of Fort Dodge's most popular family-owned restaurants is up for sale, but it comes with a price beyond dollars. At the Tom Thumb Drive-In, Kirk Canary vows to make sure the high standards for food and customer-friendly service set by his father are maintained by whomever might purchase the 52-year-old restaurant. It has been up for sale for almost 3 years. We've had a lot of people come and look, he said. I want them to continue to go with our traditions. It would be foolish to come in and change the menu or to change our commitment to customer service. I believe we're successful because of what we do and how we do it. Meanwhile, Kearney, 57, has no intention of letting up on the gas despite the long hours, 4 a.m. to 1 to 2 p.m. 6 days a week, and his staffing challenges that come with the territory and the only job he's ever had since joining the family business right out of high school. When my father died, he said, people asked what was going to happen to Tom Thumb. Nothing is going to change. We were here yesterday, and we're here today, and we'll be here tomorrow. I have every intention of doing what my father has done, find someone to run the business. The restaurant is located on the city's west side, across U.S. Highway 169, from Iowa Central Community College. It is open from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. 7 days a week, and serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and has a loyal customer following, and a huge alumni association of hundreds who worked there as part-timers over the years, learning the values of customer service and hard work. In a review of Tom Thumb a year ago, Raymond Goldfield, a travel writer on the website Only in Your State, wrote, "The old-school drive-in is as far from dead in Iowa, and heading to Fort Dodge will uncover one of the best out there. The Tom Thumb drive-in has been operating since the 1950s, with some regulars proudly announcing that they've been going there for half a century or more. But unlike so many similar places, the drive-in restaurant in Iowa doesn't limit itself to car traffic. It actually doubles as a small diner, allowing people to enjoy their meals in a charming, old-school setting. The surprisingly extensive menu dishes out retro comfort food that sometimes feels like it hasn't changed since the 1950s, but that's part of the charm. So hop in the car, order up, and take a trip back in time at this one-of-a-kind Iowa eatery." Helping bring more customer traffic to the restaurant is a Dairy Queen franchise it owns and is housed in the same building, with its own in-store counter and separate drive-thru window. Dairy Queen is a national name, Kearney said. It's a big draw. Tom Thumb's retro comfort food, mentioned by the writer, includes the restaurant's most popular menu item, the chicken and noodles over mashed potatoes and gravy. My father started that, Kearney said. I had never heard of it, but we sell a lot of everything, hamburgers and tenderloin sandwiches. We have a smoker, and we smoke all our own products. My father started doing the smoking years ago, and I took it over 15 years ago. I'm in at 4 in the morning to get it started, so many people tell us that our ribs are the best they've ever had. We also smoke ribs, brisket, pork loin, pulled pork, brats. We used to use apple wood, but now we use cherry and hickory to smoke everything. The seasoning we use is made by Jim Ertle, who worked with my father. Ertle created his Ertle famous seasoning in 1959, and it remains in use today, minus the paprika, for all of Tom Thumb's meat menu items, as well as his recipe for beef gravy. Ertle, who Kirk Kearney said was a great chef, now lives in Webster City. Tom Thumb's roots trace to Kirk's father, Tom Kearney, a pioneer in the phenomenon of drive-through restaurants that began popping up in Fort Dodge in the 1950s and 60s. In 1959, he left his job in sales with Farner Bakken Wholesale Tobacco Co. to purchase Bowen Drug at 1st Avenue North and 8th Street and create Tom's Lunch, which he owned and operated for 6 years. You could buy 13 or 15 burgers for a dollar, legend has it, Kirk said. In 1965, Tom purchased Henry's Hamburgers on 2nd Avenue South and built a second Henry's Hamburgers at the Crossroad Mall in a building where Jamar Drive-In restaurant is now located. He built Tom Thumb Drive in 1971 and owned and operated it until his death in 2018 at the age of 89. He owned or had partial ownership in numerous other businesses, including Henry's Hamburgers in Des Moines and Embroria, Kansas, Tom Thumb Deli, Tom Thumb Catering, 3 Dairy Queens, and 2 P&P convenience stores. He purchased the Villager, which was the original Colonial Inn, with Jim Ertle in 1978. 2 years later, Ertle and Kearney built the Colonial Inn in Bankshot and operated until 1998, when it was destroyed by a fire. They also managed the food service cafeteria at the Iowa Central Community College for 8 years. Tom Kearney and his wife of 65 years, Phyllis, donated to Iowa Central Community College in 2011 the land on which the Colonial Inn once stood. The college is now building a 9,200-square-foot fuel testing laboratory on the site that includes land also donated by Casey's General Stores. Groundbreaking took place July 17th. Phyllis Kearney, who is 90, continues to live in the family home just north of Fort Dodge. Perhaps the most important legacy of Tom Kearney, one that his son works to keep alive, was his impact on people. From Tom's obituary, Tom influenced countless people through his Tom Thumb family. He was a role model, father figure, and mentor. He taught customer service and hard work while helping young people become responsible adults. There's a tie between Tom Thumb and Jamar Drive-In, another popular Fort Dodge family-owned restaurant. Tom Kearney and Jim Jordanson were partners in opening up the Henry's Restaurant at 2nd Avenue South and 3rd Street, Kirk said. Jim opened Jamar in 1971, at the same time Tom opened Tom Thumb, and today Jamar is operated by Jim's son, Jerry. "We've always been friends," Kirk said. "Our businesses still work together from time to time. We've always been that way. We're very similar restaurants. Our fathers work together, and now their sons run their businesses." Kirk Kearney started working for his father when he was 12, washing dishes at the Colonial Inn, which once stood what is now a parking lot near Tom Thumb on its north side. The day after he graduated on Sunday, 1984, from St. Edmund High School, Kirk was at work at Tom Thumb the next day and has been in the business since. His brother Kevin and sister Chris also worked for their father. Kevin was the night manager at Tom Thumb and then ran the Tom Thumb Deli on 15th Street until 1989. Chris now lives with her family in Urbandale, and Kevin lives with his family in Altoona. Kirk worked at Tom Thumb for 2 years, joined the food service enterprise across the highway at Iowa Central for 3 years, and then returned to Tom Thumb in 1989. "Restaurant work is hard work," he said. "Someone once mentioned to me, it must be so hard to work for your father since his standards are so high. My standards are through the ceiling, but those standards are hard to maintain anymore." Like most restaurant owners, Kearney is challenged by a shortage of staff. Tom Thumb employs 45 to 55 people in full-time and part-time roles. The shortage was most acute during the COVID outbreak 3 years ago. "About 20% of our employees are 14 to 15 years old," he said. "It's a challenge to work with them. It's been fun to work with them when they really want to work. I've learned to be a lot more patient with them than I had been, and I think it comes with having grandchildren." Kearney has a daughter, Amanda, a schoolteacher who lives in Greenwood, Indiana, and 3 stepsons from an earlier marriage, Austin, Zach, and Tyler, and grandchildren, Hayden, Ava, and Orth. 2 of an original group of 4 from Tom Kearney's management days are still at the restaurant. Kirk Moore is the day manager of Tom Thumb's and has been with the company 38 years. Mike Chardulius was a night manager for 39 years until his death a year ago. He had worked in the family business, the Melody Grill, from the age of 9 until it closed in 1982, when he joined Tom Thumb. Kevin Parks was Tom Thumb's bakery manager, making all of its breads and buns that were once sold to a dozen or other businesses. He died August 19th. "All of us, we had an extremely high work ethic," Kearney said. "All became successful through the restaurant. Kirk Moore and I survived 2 old dogs in the building. When we were hired, we didn't ask what we were going to do, what our pay would be. You just showed up, you never questioned it, and you did it." Kearney said that he is still looking for a baker and an assistant manager. The restaurant sports a large menu with about 30 meat dishes alone, and still makes and sells pies and rolls. "Most restaurants in Fort Dodge these days belong to chains," Kearney said, adding, "It's hard to be a little guy in the big guy's world. But we've survived. It's kind of like the old television show Cheers, where everyone wants to know your name. I think of Tom Thumb in that way. It's kind of like a small community. We know so many of the families. It's amazing to see how many families keep coming in. It's the Tom Thumb family. The seasoning that we use was made by Jim Ertle from my father's days." there is a little more personality and person-to-person touch than in a corporate setting. I'd like Tom Thumb to never go away. It's a unique business. Let's finish off today with some more sports from the Fort Dodge Messenger, starting with Back to the Drawing Board. The Fort Dodge football team's mercurial ways continues on Friday, as the Dodgers were simply no match for ninth-ranked Lamar. The Bulldogs topped the 40-point mark for the fifth time this season while holding a fifth opponent to two scores or fewer in an impressive 42-7 victory. Lamar's looks more than comfortable in District 1A's driver's seat at 3-0 in the league and 6-1 overall. Head coach Nick Moser's squad, meanwhile, struggled again to sustain success. A week after appearing to have turned a corner in a rout of Storm Lake, Fort Dodge managed just 152 yards off a total offense and 5 first downs. We have to do a better job of handling adversity and digging out of a hole when things don't go our way, Moser said. Both the first and the second half started really poorly, and it ended up setting the tone as far as how things were going to go. We had a few chances to change the momentum in the narrative, but we just didn't fight our way through it. Lamar was a more physical team, period. We weren't very good last night, from myself and the coaches on down. We have to keep working and keep fighting to shake this every other game stigma. The Dodgers have alternated wins and losses since week one. It's up to us now, again, in terms of how we respond. Veteran quarterback Tegan Kazel continued to play well, throwing for 108 yards and running 90 for 90 more. Kazel had an almost even distribution between passing and rushing yards, coming into the contest with nearly 900 yards of total offense. Kazel only had 2 incomplete passes all evening and scored on 3 short touchdown jaunts. Fort Dodge, meanwhile, had only 6 total receptions for 80 yards through the air. The Bulldog defense was unrelenting, giving up just a 35-yard touchdown run by Jamarius Gibbs Green in the second quarter. They beat us in all 3 phases of the game, Moser said. Offense, defense, and a special teams were won by Lamar's. They're a solid 6-1 ball club, but I just feel like we are better than what we showed on Friday. We have to start proving that on a more consistent basis. The Bulldogs, who start 16 seniors to the Dodgers 8, immediately set the tone on an interception return down the Fort Dodge first yard line less than 2 minutes into the first quarter. Ahead 21-7 at intermission, the third period started in a similar fashion as Lamar's returned the kickoff into Dodger territory and scored almost immediately. 4 Bulldog touchdown drives started on the Fort Dodge side of the field, including 2 in the red zone. They don't do anything fancy, Moser said of Lamar's. They're just tough up front and fundamentally sound. Gibbs Green rushed for 74 yards, and senior Grant Williams had a 38-yard catch, a 17-yard completion on a fake punt, and 4 punts of over 40 yards. Fort Dodge senior Cal Hartman recovered a fumble on a muffed punt to set up the Gibbs Green score. Senior Zeke Pinata had a fumble recovery as well. The Dodgers were without two-way start Dreshawn Ross, who sprained his ankle at Storm Lake and missed most of the contest as well. Ross is expected to be back at Sioux City West this week. Now let's finish off today with Gale's stay in the playoff hunt. JT Laufertzweiler announced for 7 touchdowns, and the St. Edmund football team received a key interception from Jacob Koopman late here Friday to upset Colo Nesco 48-42. Playing shorthanded, the Gales were able to snap a 3-game district losing skid, keeping home alive for a playoff bid. Laufersweiler, a senior who threw for 300 yards and 4 touchdowns, as Grant Gallows caught 9 for 177 with 3 scores. The 4th passing touchdown by Laufersweiler was the game winner as it deflected off the hands of Gales into the hands of Kinnick Henning in the end zone with just over 4 minutes to go. Koopman picked off a Colo Nesco Brecken Klatz on the ensuing drive and St. Edmund was able to run out the clock with a pair of first downs. That was a heck of a game between two teams who gave it everything they had, SEHS head coach Matt Dillon said. That is what high school football is about. We've had some big plays from guys all night long, and in the end, we were able to get the win. There's still plenty of to be sorted out, but we had to have this one to give ourselves a chance at the playoffs. Now we'll see what happens next week. Sam Beyer ran for a career-high 193 yards on 28 carries, scoring a pair of key early two-point conversions after the short Laufersweiler touchdown runs. Laufersweiler added a third rushing score in the third quarter, finishing with 49 yards on the ground. For the Royals, Mark Bauer ran for 138 yards and three touchdowns, while Lucas Frohwein caught two scores from Klatt. The loss snapped a three-game win streak for Colonesco and spoiled senior night. The two teams exchanged touchdowns early before St. Edmund reeled off three consecutive scores between the second and the third quarters. The Royals, though, answered back with 16 straight points before Laufersweiler hit Galleys on 4th and 13 for a 37-yard strike. JT stepped up, and Grant made an incredible play, staying in bounds and taking it to the house, Dillon said. We felt like it might be one of those games where the team with the ball last wins. I am just glad that we were the ones who got the big plays late in Koopman's interception, converted a couple of first downs, and got out there with it. Meyer was the workhorse on the second half, wearing down the Colonesco defense with 17 rushes and 137 yards, including a big 137 yards in the opening 24 minutes, and was 8 for 16 for 163 after the break. Koopman finished with 6 receptions for 64 yards, and Leo N. caught 3 passes for 45. Adam Walker had a sack, and Quinton Jeschke has recovered a fumble. St. Edmund will now head home to conclude this regular season next Friday at Dodger Stadium versus Gideon Ralston. The Wildcats topped Coon Rapids Bayard last night 24-6. We will actually have one more article. Iowa Central will play homecoming contest under the lights. Following a week to rest and recover, the third-ranked Iowa Central football team begins a key stretch here Saturday evening. The Tritons take on Coffeyville at Dodger Stadium for homecoming. Kickoff is set for 7 p.m. Iowa Central, 4-1 overall, will play back-to-back games at home before hitting the road to finish out month. That includes 14th-ranked Butler next week, number 11-ranked Dodge City in 2 weeks, and key October 28th shutdown with the 2nd-ranked Iowa Western and Council Bluffs. But at first, they must navigate a tricky opponent in the Red Ravens, 1-4, who opened the year ranked top 10 before a series of close defeats. This is a very important 5-game stretch upcoming for us, ICCC head coach Jesse Montalo said. But first, we have to take care of business against a very good Coffeyville team. The kids are excited to be under the lights. We've had several practices under the lights, and they've always had great juice to them. The Tritons have picked up convincing 41-14 and 62-13 triumphs over top-ranked college DuPage and Ellsworth since a 27-2 loss to number 1 Hutchinson. They kicked off the season with back-to-back wins over Independence and Garden City. Justin Silverstein directs an offensive averaging almost 380 yards and 33 points per game. The sophomore quarterback is completing 55% of his throws for 929 yards with 10 touchdowns, adding 122 yards and 2 touchdown scores on the ground. Mario Sanders, who continues to gain interest from high-level FBS programs, ranks among the national leaders in receiving with 41 catches for 617 yards and 8 scores. Michael Bartolotta has 125 yards receiving, and Harold Trainer, the fourth, has 71. Jalen Washington paces the ground attack with 154 yards and 2 scores, while Adriel Fussell has 84 and 3 touchdowns.
We've worked hard over these last couple weeks to shore up the run game, Montalto said. We're coming out of the bye 4-1, just like last year, but we are in better shape in terms of health of the players. We were able to give them some rest and get them closer to 100%. Coffeyville got into the win column last Saturday with a 64-0 victory over Ellsworth. They started the year with losses to Highland, Dodge City, and Independence by a combined 18 points before losing to Hutchinson 37-7. Freshman Connor Apo has thrown for 304 yards, and sophomore Jeremiah Moore has 253 yards with two touchdowns. Amiri Wiggins has rushed for 358 yards and four scores, averaging almost 72 yards per game to lead the Red Ravens. Marcus Johnson and Christian Crenshaw are the top receivers, as Johnson has 11 catches for 152 yards, and Crenshaw has 8 for 76. Coffeyville was picked to finish second in Kansas Jayhawk Community College Conference behind only Hutchinson in the preseason. They also placed second last year in the league race. If Apo plays those early games, they are definitely not 1-4, Montalto said. He is a pretty special quarterback that can pull the trigger and is very athletic. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Sunday, October 8th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.